The brother of James Earl Ray, John Larry Ray, writing in his book Truth at Last with Lyndon Barston. We'll be back with both of them in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Lyndon Barston, John Larry Ray. John Larry, you know, it's been 40 years since the assassination. Why write the book now? I mean, what took you so long?
Well, I kind of gag. My brother, I didn't know all the details until 1974 when I was incarcerated in Shelby County Jail in Tennessee. And with my brother, my cellmate, see, and he's back in jail getting a rehearing, and I was in going to be his one of his witnesses to bring out information about Percy Foreman, you know, what went down in the contracts and so forth. Well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but at that time I was in the Marion Federal Prison. And they shipped me down there, and to protect me and him both, that's why they put us in the same cell, see? And, but I was kind of upset because I almost was killed a couple of times myself over what went down in this King assassination, and I didn't know what's going on. So I had two questions in my mind when I checked in the jail with my brother. One, why didn't the mafia pay him $50,000 because they had no reason to kill King, see? And secondly, why did he plead guilty in 1969? What the main reason, you know, him pleading guilty, because there was no evidence of, was even in a state of Tennessee the day King was killed. And Percy Foreman brought all this out first, his attorney, so then why they all of a sudden he pleaded guilty to it? And that's the question I want to know when I check in the cell. And two questions when I check in his cell state.
So, but you believe that you were not ready to write the book until just a few years ago then, right?
Well, I was kind of on a code of silence from him, right? Because I didn't know what he's into with the CIA. See, you can't make that type of information put on his back while he's serving time with people killing inmates.
Right.
And stuff like that. And then I was in the dark. So, but soon he died in 1998. I wrote three letters, one to U.S. Attorney General John Marino, explain what I'm explaining here, and one to director of the FBI. I can't remember who was director of the FBI at the time. Same thing, but nobody wanted to know what's going down. They ignored me, see.
And the last one to Mrs. King, by the way.
Yeah, one to Scott King. I wrote to him to Scott King and told her about a shooting at Soldier Washington, and for her to get the information from her good friend, Attorney General John Marino, before she leaves office. And I didn't hear no more about it, but I know, see, it was put so much heat on Coretta Scott King at the time, as you see come up with James getting a new trial, it's all right and loud derogatory stuff by her.
Let me ask you this, though, John, so I can understand that you had to wait until your brother died, and that makes sense to protect him. Did he ever look you in the eyes, John Larry, did he ever look you in the eyes and say, I didn't do this?
Well, no, I never did ask that question, but he just assumed I knew he didn't do it, see, because the last circumstance, the evidence, it came out, proves he didn't do it, you know what I mean? Like a military shooting of Soldier Washington, and when he told me that's why he had to plead guilty, he's going to bring this shooting of this black Soldier Washington out and put a racial spin on it,
right?
And put
right.
him on death row, and he knew he could do it, and that's the main reason he pleaded, more or less had to plead guilty. He said he was boxed in, and that's where I had to kind of back away because I didn't know what's going down there, and I didn't want him to get killed behind bars. Or it wasn't my problem anyway, it's his problem. My problem was I was getting the heat myself. My own life was being put in jeopardy. I almost burned a Queen Mary alive in a cell over there.
Well, in the times when you owned the bar, and was that before the assassination or was that after?
That was a couple of months before assassination.
Before, okay. Oh. I mean, at any time, did anybody, James Earl Ray or anyone, sit down? Did you overhear them talking about some kind of assassination plot of Martin Luther King Jr.?
No. They claim a big conspiracy went down in 1967 in the Great Mind Ball of named different people's right. But the problem there is the Grapevine Bar didn't open in 1967, opened in 1968, January of 1968. So there couldn't be no conspiracy in the Grapevine Bar in 1947 when it wasn't even open. You know?
And Linda, let me bring you in here for a moment as well. When you said you believe James Earl Ray was a patsy,
yes.
Was he involved at all in this?
No. If anything, it would scare away the patsy to let him know that this type of thing was going down. The other thing that I would say about John knowing that James was innocent and only a patsy is they were together on April 3rd, 1968. They met one another. So John is very aware of what was going on in James' head immediately before the assassination.
And where was that meeting, that get-together? In what city? Was it in Memphis or where?
John, maybe do you want to answer that?
Oh, West Memphis. I met him there April 3rd, and we discussed him then. I don't think it's been brought out here, but it's in a book I laid out where, see, James said $50,000 for a mafia boss in East St. Louis, Illinois, soon to escape from prison. And it's supposed to be for the diamond burglary of Diamond Heist, and he's supposed to be in Canada, and he went to Canada to do it, but it didn't take place, so ordered him back from Canada. And when he got in jail down there, I found out all his information. I didn't know. I know about him getting the $50,000, but I didn't know about it didn't say how he. But in that West Memphis meeting, he didn't even know himself. He had to meet some people back across the river, but he wanted the person he took the $50,000 from was a friend of mine named James O'Brien, Jimmy O'Brien, and for his diamond job in Canada. But he said he was setting him up on something, he didn't know what. And that's why he wanted me to get connected with Jimmy O'Brien to find out was supposed to be in the diamond job and study. He's getting him old wives or something. There might be something else, but he didn't know what it was. See?
All right, Lyndon, let me ask you this, and then we're going to come back and fill in some of these gaps as we build this, because it's very important if James Earl Ray didn't do it to get both of you to give me some of your take on who you think did or why. But how did James Earl Ray, several months after the assassination, end up in London, end up with a false passport from a guy who we all now believe did just, you know, petty crimes? How did this happen?
Well, he obviously had help, and it appears that after the assassination, he believed that he had been double-crossed, got paranoid, went to Canada. And apparently they picked up with him in Canada, although that can't be proved. But there's a number of things about the travels of James Earl Ray which are very peculiar. His main alias during 1967 and 1968 is Eric S. Galt. And there is a real Eric S. Galt, and it was a gentleman from Toronto who looked extremely like James Earl, was a few years older but looked young, and had a security clearance. Now, obviously, the plotters wouldn't want to lose their patsy. So here you have a situation where the name given the patsy is a name with a security clearance attached to it. So chances are, if he ever got into trouble with any of these illegal doings that are going on, they could walk him out of the situation. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So they helped walk him out of the situation.
John is clear that when James was supposedly captured in London, it was more of a, I'm giving myself up, that a deal had been struck, that they were going to get him off with very little time.
And do you believe that James Earl Ray was beginning to put together the pieces of this bizarre puzzle where he was being accused?
Oh, without question. Yeah, he always told the truth, I believe, that as he was driving away from the scene of the crime, that he heard on the radio that Martin Luther King has been shot, and they're looking for a white man in a white, it was actually pale yellow, Mustang. The government came out in later years and said that his radio was broken, but I believe that his radio actually worked and that James absolutely told the truth. He had no foreknowledge, that he was not an aider and abettor, that he was absolutely an innocent man.
Do you think he knew the players, the people that could have been involved in the assassination?
Without question.
Okay, so he did. So it wasn't as if he came out of left field somewhere. He knew them, and didn't know what was going on.
Well, when John went to Shelby County Jail in 1974 and said, "Why would the mafia want King dead? It doesn't make any sense." James told him, the government, meaning, you know, maybe FBI, counterintelligence, military intelligence, the CIA, works with the mob because, and this is something that Mark Lane always said, because it gives you deniability, plausible deniability, in case something goes wrong with the crime. They don't want to catch a government, you know, covert operative there. The person that they want to catch there is somebody associated with the mob. And to have James Earl's money, and in turn, John bought the Grapevine with some of this money, to have James Earl's money come from Jimmy O'Brien, who works for Buster Wertman. Buster Wertman, it's very clear in FBI documents, it is a surrogate of the Chicago mob, and it's legendary now, and there's no denying it, that the Chicago mob worked hand in glove with the Central Intelligence Agency at that time.
If you're going to assassinate an individual on your own, you're doing it because you don't like the person. You don't like his policies. You could be a racist. Who knows what your motives are, but you obviously don't like the individual you're about ready to shoot, unless you're a hired hitman. Now, John Larry Ray, at any time that you were dealing with your brother, did he say anything negative about Martin Luther King? Did he say anything, I hate the guy, or anything like that?
No, he didn't express anything one way or another about the 11 and King. In fact, the feds are making up a lot of race anti-black stories you see over and over again, but example, I helped him escape as F.C. the penitentiary when he escaped in 1967.
You did that?
We sat in the bar in East St. Louis in the Miami Lounge, and we discussing the home rent, two black home rent leaders who was going to break Babe Ruth's record, William Mays at the time and Hank Aaron.
Right, right.
If he was racist, as portrayed by the government, we wouldn't we might have been discussing which one's going to break the home run record. I just give this kind of example of what I'm talking about, say. And I didn't actually have no problems. Blacks, we haven't been in any type of Klansman or you know, white citizens council and all that stuff inside out, or Aaron Brotherhood, inside outside prison. So usually, if you're a racist, you got a track record of being that, see?
Sure, absolutely.
You don't come out 4 years old, all of a sudden you become a racist, see? We had our own life to live, and we actually wasn't involved in, you know, with the civil rights and stuff like that, one way or another. We more or less, I guess you consider a pedagogical criminals, I guess, you know. Our job was more or less keeping alive, making money, not to run around and come and shooting.
Well, John Larry Ray, how do you feel about the fact that the family of Martin Luther King Jr. does not believe that your brother, James Earl Ray, committed the assassination? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think the way it might feel a little bit about that, too, because I sent her a letter and told her to contact Joanna Vino about shooting a soldier Washington, about James being connected with the CIA all the way back to in the mid-40s. She has that information too, so I imagine she's getting some of that information from me, and it's just proof about Jane's connection with the CIA, see.
So when this assassination occurred, and you heard the name of your brother tied into this, did you say to yourself, he didn't do this? Or did you think maybe he did?
No, I didn't think he did, because well, I met him the day before. I see he's highly nervous. He didn't know what was going down. And something took place there, which, see, we see self different people on this side of the fence and people on the other side of the fence. I'm talking about some person that has a prison record. You know?
Right.
So when I saw him, the getaway driver, I suppose he pulled a better getaway driver, drove all the way from the Memphis, Tennessee to Atlanta, Georgia. All criminals, you use a Swiss car about two blocks away at the stage. He did that on all his prior crimes, in Missouri robberies and Chicago robberies. And so when I said that shows you he didn't know what's going on. Well, you wouldn't have been driving that Mustang, see?
Now you were in the area the day before, right?
Uh-huh.
On the day of the assassination, where were you?
I was back in the Grapevine in St. Louis.
That was your bar?
Yes.
Okay.
And when I first heard about King getting assassinated, somebody ran in the bar and said, shot at King down there in Memphis. And the same guy, he ran up the street and hauled to the door to another tavern owner. She told me about it. I know the one. Nobody saw him. He's a modern-day Paul Revere. I guess nobody saw him before or after.
Why did your brother stay in Memphis? Why didn't he come back with you?
One of the reasons I was down there, he saw me down there. He wanted to be in contact with this Jimmy O'Brien, but I told him he might have came back with me, but I told him Jimmy O'Brien wasn't, we lost track and we couldn't find out where he's at, see?
All right, well, hold on. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be right back with both of you on Coast to Coast AM. Floating format tonight, last hour of the program, I'll have open lines. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you to chat with our two guests, Lyndon Barston, John Larry Ray, authors of the book Truth at Last. And we'll be back with both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lyndon, you have looked at so many documents here related to this case. What was it and when was it when you said to yourself, I don't think James Earl Ray did this?
Well, I think you get a good feeling for people. I would say when I sat down to talk to him, I thought, this man is not who he's supposed to be. John Abel is one of the reporters that I think first discovered this, in that a picture was trying to, the feds And it's clear that the federal government has at least at that time, had assets in the press that would do the bidding of the federal government. As a matter of fact, Lyndon Johnson is in the White House tape says we need some of our own people in the press. But there was an attempt to make James Earl into a violent person, which even after leaving the army, when he was performing criminal acts, they were never violent. They were always nonviolent. He never banged anybody on the head or anything like that. And one of the stories that was floated around quite a bit in 1968 was that James, when John and he were kids, that James, over a scrap of meat, took a knife and cut John's ear to get some of the meat that John had, and it's just it's contrary to the character of the person that I knew, and John Abel went into the grapevine, and one of the first things that he wanted to see was the scar on Brother John's ear, and there was no scar. So where does this story come from? You see,
it's
totally fiction.
What the case, of course, is a strange one indeed. And let me ask you, John Larry, that when you were talking to your brother, did he ever mention a conspiracy? Did he ever mention who he thought might be involved in this?
Well, he said a couple of times when I first met him and had the interview with him and I met McGill, not the time I saw with him, but the time before that when he walked back from London, he said, I'm not the only person involved in this. And prior to that, he had Pete, was giving him money, and if people was involved in it, but how it all came down, you know. But he never even when he pled guilty to it, he didn't say. In fact, he stood up in court and he said he was legal guilty. The legal guilty is like a hidden banner, conspiracy means anything. And that's why he even told Martin Luther King's son. He did not shoot King, see? So he always, until his death, he never did give a confession to anybody or anything else that he actually shot King.
And Dexter King believed Martin Luther, believed James Earl Ray, that he did not kill his father.
Yes, he made quite a few statements about that. And he believes that. So James Earl Ray, even on his deathbed, had tried to put words in his mouth several person to, you know, to give a deathbed statement that he did shoot King and he wanted to do it back to the deathbed. So he never did say he killed King. The only thing he met was his being involved in conspiracy to it when he pleaded guilty to it. They didn't ask him at a trial that he killed King because they know he was he said legally I could be, you know, accused of.
All right, Lyndon, was he tricked to go to Memphis during that time period?
He absolutely was tricked. He believed that he was running guns at that time.
Now, what do you mean by running guns? Taking them where?
Well, he knew that there were gun buyers, and that he was dealing in guns for, you know, perhaps it was anti-Castro, anti-communist fighters. But John knew that. And as a matter of fact, when John went down to meet him on the 3rd of April, John had a couple guns for him because John knew that his brother was not looking to murder Martin Luther King, but looking was dealing in guns. And James told him, you know, no, I don't need your guns right now.
Okay. Now, John Larry, I have, you know, I'm in St. Louis now, so I've lived here since 79. I go back and forth between here and Los Angeles, but I always had heard rumors that somebody walked into the bar and offered anybody $50,000 to kill Martin Luther King. And strangely, you know, James Earl Ray had money from the mob. Had you ever heard that story?
The story was that story didn't come out until a House Select Committee on Assassination. Ed created that story himself. At two businessmen in the south of St. Louis that came in the tavern and put a $50,000 bounty on King. And some people in Jesse prison came in the tavern too. Had two three different groups that, you know, that said that putting his bounty out. But that's the fact is it being possible, because James Earl Ray got in money in 1967. In summer 67, the grapevine didn't even open until January 1968.
Right. Yeah, you'd mentioned that. Okay, so.
If you go back to, if you go back and look at the FBI records, when they first investigated the case, there's nothing in the FBI record about anybody being involved in the grapevine or nothing. See? That's
okay. And Lyndon, just so we're clear here, why or how did James Earl Ray get the $50,000 again?
It was given to him very shortly after his escape, rather shortly after his escape from prison at Jeff City in 1967. And John was actually, you know, reasonably involved here. James Earl escaped on the 23rd of April, which was a Sunday. But over the next few days, John took his brother to one person, and that didn't pan out. And then he took him over to his friend Jimmy O'Brien's, who worked for the East St. Louis mob at that time, the Buster Workman mob.
And when you say took him over what, hide him?
They went and saw Jimmy O'Brien, who had been John's friend, and they stayed next to the bar that Buster Workman owned at that time was called the Paddock Lounge.
Okay.
And there was, next door to that, there was a building that John more or less called a safe house, and that the first contact was then between James Earl and Jimmy O'Brien, and that they stayed at that safe house. James didn't feel very safe there, but that they stayed at this safe house owned by Workman, and that a agreement was reached. James went up to Chicago for very shortly afterwards, came back down and got this sum of money, and John was given money by his brother at that time, and John's money is the money that he used to buy a moving truck in 1967, and the building that his bar, the Grapevine, was in.
Okay, but I mean, getting the $50,000, what did they give it to him for?
He was to be an operative, and John. What John knows about it is that his brother called it these diamond deals, that he was supposed to be a mob operative. He would be acting as more or less a mule. What John says about that this particular time is his brother told as much truth as he possibly could. He wiped out some of this other information, you know, about the CIA and whatnot, but that he was more or less a mule working. There was a real person, Raul, that he was working with Raul, and that they were transporting contraband. Apparently, it was at least partly diamonds. Oddly enough, Gerald Frank, the author, who is a government line author, also says, kind of out of the blue at one point in An American Death, that they were transporting diamonds. That he was transporting diamonds, that he was essentially a mule for the mob, transporting a contraband across the Canadian-U.S. border at Detroit. And this is why the security clearance that was associated with the name Eric Galt was important. Mm-hmm. You know, he was doing potentially dangerous stuff that law enforcement could pick him up. Well, if he did get picked up transporting, you know, diamonds, there might have been drugs in there. If he did get picked up as a mule, the feds would be able to walk their valuable patsy out of there.
Well, okay, so somebody gives him the $50,000. Do you think it was also given to him because eventually they would have known that after the assassination, of which Ray apparently knew nothing about, that they traced this $50,000, which is probably closer to $100,000 in today's dollars?
Oh, God, yes.
And people would assume he was paid off for the assassination. Do you think they gave him the $50,000 as part of the scheme?
Well, there's probably a lot of reasons. For one thing, if the mob gives you a large sum of money, you're not going to take off to parts unknown. You know what I'm saying? Because A, your life probably isn't worth that much if you do so.
Right. But this was not a loan shark loan, was it?
It was not a loan. No. He was paid to do a job, and he obviously, you know, was to stay on that job. There was apparently one point when he was in Canada that he was getting kind of spooked and was thinking of taking off to parts unknown. And John said to him, you know, don't do that because I'm here and your family's here. You know, obviously, James Earl was dealing with some very, very dangerous people at this time. You know,
now, Linda, okay, after he escaped from Jefferson City, did he ever get captured and brought back?
He didn't get captured until London, which...
Until the assassin. So he was on the lam that long.
He was on the lam that long. And this is another thing that if you hear that there's a bounty on Martin Luther King, and you're out to collect that bounty, are you going to spend the next year going up to Canada and doing other things? It doesn't make logical sense. The other thing about this bounty, this bounty that the House Select Committee on Assassinations came up with this story, mm-hmm. in 77, 78, and 79. This bounty is something that I've combed through all 40,000 pages that was released to Harold Weisberg of the Merkin file, the investigative file of Dr. King's death. The National Archives is coming out with more. But there, with that gigantic investigation, That took place in 1968 dollars, $1.5 million dollar investigation of Dr. King's death. There is not one word about this supposed bounty that was a St. Louis plot that James Earl Ray supposedly heard of, and they certainly would have come across that. The word on the street about that bounty is that the story was starting to fall apart that James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King as a racist act. It didn't make any sense because, for one thing, James Earl always lived in the most integrated places and always went to integrated clubs. And there's no sign whatsoever that this is someone who would want to kill Martin Luther King because of racist ideology.
Right.
And so they had to come up with something believable. And they thought that this $50,000 bounty was believable. Now, I've known people in law enforcement and people that, you know, looked at that. And one of them, Jim Green, who had a life with federal strike forces, one of them, Jim Green, laughed at the idea of a general bounty being put out, like a word being put out, you kill this person and we'll give you $50,000.
Yeah, that's crazy.
They don't operate that way. Plots don't operate like that. He said, and it makes logical sense. If there was a general bounty put out and there was not a signature left at the crime, a way of verifying who did it, you'd have every con artist in the whole country showing up saying, I did it, give me my $50,000.
Well, and here's the other thing, Lyndon. You know, Dr. King shot on the balcony of the hotel in Memphis. The gunman obviously out there and ready. How did they know this? How did they know he was going to be on the balcony, for crying out loud? How did they know all this?
Well, Dr. King was going to a housewarming party of a local Memphis minister, Billy Kiles. Billy Kiles is still alive, by the way. And the time that he was leaving was well known.
Okay.
He was actually late.
What do you mean well known? I mean, who would have known? I mean, you had to be in the inn to know it, though, wouldn't you? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So somebody in this assassination attempt, somebody knew the time he was coming out, knew where he was going to stay, knew where to be. I mean, it's way too organized, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And it was towards the end of Dr. King's visit in Memphis. If James Earl Ray wanted to shoot Dr. King, good Lord. I mean,
he's not going to drive by in his Mustang, pull out a rifle, know when he was going to come out of a hotel, know what hotel he was in. I don't think he was stalking him. You know, it wasn't one of those Arthur Bremer cases where George Wallace got shot. Bremer knew where he was. He had gone to several of Wallace's speaking engagements. I mean, he was truly stalking the man. I don't think James Earl Ray was doing that in this case, was he?
No, he rolled into town at the last possible minute. He was doing as he was told, as a mule for the mob.
Well, let me then ask you this, and we're going to take phone calls with both of you next hour as well. Let's make this great assumption tonight, then, that your theories are correct, John Aubel's are correct, that James Earl Ray was not the assassin, was a patsy, that the family of Martin Luther King Jr., they're correct, that James Earl Ray had nothing to do with this as well. Who did it and why? What do you think, Lyndon?
Well, the actual shooter, I mean, James Earl believed that it was Raul, who was one of his handlers, but he didn't see the shot fired. He was sitting down below. He was only there for transportation. Who did it? I'd say Richard Helms and J. Edgar Hoover.
That's pretty big names, Lyndon.
Yes.
Pretty big names. And they wanted to get King out of the way because, what, he was too popular? He was generating something that they didn't want to occur in this country.
Well, they hated Dr. King. It is not any theory. It is not disputed that the FBI in December of 1964 attempted to get Dr. King to commit suicide. They sent Mrs. King a tape, supposedly of Dr. King's infidelity. And with a letter saying, if you don't commit suicide, the story of this will be told.
Okay,
to the country.
Look, we're going to take this break. Also, Hoover could have been involved in JFK's assassination. We'll be back.